My story is not a simple one. I was born Prince Menkhepere, which means eternal are the manifestations of Re, the god you call Ra. I am the second son of the mighty pharaoh Thutmose III, the great military genius of Egypt, who conquered 350 cities in his reign, capturing all of them from the Euphrates across to Canaan and down to Nubia. My father transformed Egypt into an empire that would be measured in dynasties, and then my brother nearly destroyed it. As I said, I am the second son of Thutmose III. When my father died after reigning over 50 years, my brother, Amenhotep II, became pharaoh at the age of 18. Within 5 years, my brother was dead, Egypt was plundered and decimated, and soon to become the laughingstock of all the nations. To avoid embarrassment, I assumed my brother's throne and his name, and have reigned as Amenhotep II ever since, as if nothing ever happened. I do not do this for the sake of my brother. I do it for the sake of Egypt. For Pharaoh is Egypt. Pharaoh is the supreme ruler of Egypt because he is himself God. I am Horus incarnate. I am the son of Re, lord of diadems. And it is impossible for the son of Re to experience defeat. So none of the circumstances which brought us to this point will ever enter our official records. It will not be written the mistakes that we have made, the mistakes my brother made to bring us to this point. My brother. My brother, the life of the party, the athlete excelling in all sports, treated all of life as a game, a contest. Once, he was so proud of shooting an arrow through a copper target thick as a man's palm that he had the moment inscribed in stone for all time. For the life of Pharaoh is not measured by time. It is measured by stone. Stone that lasts for all time. Because the decisions that a pharaoh makes are determined by what the stones will say to future dynasties, knowing that they will look back into the stories written in the stone and recognize what is true accomplishment and what is feigned greatness. For no defeat of Egypt is ever recorded in the stones. But when the stones are silent with regard to one's reign, that silence speaks volumes of failure and defeat. My father wrote stories in the stones of conquest, expansion, growth, wealth, and power. In addition to being such a military genius, he was also one of the greatest builders Egypt will ever see. He built 50 temples, made massive additions to the great temple in Karnak. Artistic innovation, architectural developments were experienced during his reign such as would never be seen again. My brother intended to build as much as my father built during his reign. Of course, my father didn't lift a brick to build these things. He made the plans. He amassed the wealth. He gave the orders. And it was done by his slaves. The slaves made the bricks. The slaves carved the stone. The slaves moved the pylons, erected the monuments and monoliths to the pleasure and glory of Pharaoh. Because Pharaoh speaks, and his will is done, especially by the slaves. But oh, these slaves. No one can remember where they came from. It seems that hundreds of years ago, a single family of Hebrews came to Egypt, and then they multiplied like the locusts they would send upon us. But let us not step into that yet. Before we move forward in our story, let us move backward. Not so far as to when the Hebrews came over 400 years ago. Let us simply go back to the time of my great-grandfather, Thutmose I. His primary wife was Queen Ahmose. She bore him 4 children, three of whom died before his reign was complete, leaving only the royal daughter Hatshepsut. His secondary wife was Mutnofret, and she bore him a son, Thutmose II, who was obviously the half-brother to Hatshepsut. Pharaoh's daughter had a ritual in her youth. She would bathe in the Nile every morning. And one morning she came up out of the Nile carrying a basket that held an infant slave. Its mother had clearly sought to circumvent my great-grandfather's thinning project. He was exterminating the male slaves as they were born because they had grown too numerous, particularly if they should ever have the intelligence to join forces with one of our adversaries. So grandfather was thinning them out, and this one, this boy in the basket, had momentarily escaped. But then when Hatshepsut had her hands on this child, she treated it as a tigress treats her own cub. She refused to let go of it, insisted on raising it as her own. This infuriated Thutmose, but he knew where to draw the line in his battles with his high-spirited daughter, and so he let her keep it like a pet. In exchange, though, he forced her to marry her brother, Thutmose II, to ensure that his son would be the next pharaoh, which he was, in an unremarkable 14-year reign to follow. Hatshepsut gradually introduced her slave boy son into the palace culture as if it were an equal, gave it the opportunity to learn, to read, to learn to build, to learn to lead. And then when Thutmose II died, Hatshepsut became pharaoh herself and ruled competently for 22 years. And as she did so, her slave son grew to manhood and had the run of the palace and of the empire. Most Egyptians believe the story that this Moses was the son of Hatshepsut with Thutmose II. But those deep in the royal courts knew the truth, especially my father, and they kept a close watch on Moses as he grew stronger and bolder as time went on. At some point, Hatshepsut told Moses who he really was, and he changed, slowly at first, paying closer attention to the slaves as they worked, listening to their conversations here and there. But then when Hatshepsut died and her mummy rested in the Valley of the Kings, he grew bolder and took alarming interest in the slaves' condition and openly questioned Egyptian practices with regard to these slaves, practices that had built our empire out of the sand. Great accomplishment is the result of great thinking coupled with great toil. Egypt thinks, her slaves toil. One could not expect an Egyptian to stoop to such menial labor. Such crude tasks are beneath them. They were born with greater potential and given far greater opportunity than so simple a destiny. Conversely, it is no fault of the Egyptian that the slave is born into his limited circumstance, his smaller opportunities, his limited potential. Is that not a question of destiny as well? Moses sought to change that destiny. He became a vigilante, even murdered an Egyptian simply because he had mistreated a slave. Unfathomable. As if a man were to be killed simply for kicking a dog. Moses' timing was poor at best, though, because at this time my father, Thutmose III, had long been pharaoh. And my father had far more ambitious plans for his slaves than Moses. So when father learned what Moses had done, he sought Moses out to kill him. So Moses fled and was gone for many years, past the end of my father's reign. So father was able to use his slaves as he saw fit without any interference from the interloping Moses. Most Egyptians thought that he had died. Not my brother. Amenhotep. When my father began his journey to the afterlife through the Valley of the Kings, before he was dead, Amenhotep began to wipe out the memory of Hatshepsut. He struck her name from the stones so that no one of her line, particularly Moses, would have a claim to the throne after my father's death. So afraid was he of that happening. My brother was a brash fool as a youth, as I have said, and once he became Pharaoh, he was brutal in his ways. After a military campaign, not long after his ascension to the throne, he killed 7 hostage chieftains he had brought back from Taxi in Syria. He hung their heads from his royal barge as he sailed it south to Thebes. Once there, he hung 6 of the heads on the city wall and set the 7th to our southern border to warn others. Impulsive, arrogant, stubborn, before he was Pharaoh, once crowned ruler and supreme god over all Egypt, my brother was unstoppable. Or so we thought. In the 5th year of the reign of Pharaoh Amenhotep II, my brother Moses returned to Egypt after an absence of 40 years. He was nearly unrecognizable, weathered, worn, old, 80 years of age. Standing before him, my brother, in comparison, shone in his mid-20s, fiercely intelligent, handsome, perhaps the strongest man in Egypt at the time. For years he had gone down to the Nile every morning to row at dawn, racing boats filled with other men, often beating them by himself. Despite his arrogance, he was magnificent. And standing there before Moses, it was clear that Amenhotep's fears that Moses could ever successfully make a claim upon the throne were completely unfounded. But Moses had not come to claim the throne. He had come with his Hebrew brother Aaron, and stood before Amenhotep and said, "Thus says the I Am, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may celebrate a festival to me in the wilderness." None of us present thought we had heard correctly, so impossible was this demand. But my brother heard and said, "Your God said what? Wait, you only have one God? No wonder you're slaves. What is your one God to Isis, to Osiris, to Geb, Hecht, Imhotep, Re? Who is this I Am to me? I am the supreme God and ruler of Egypt, and I have never heard of your God. So I will certainly not let my slaves go on a holiday because he asks. Your God may serve Egyptian gods as his people serve me. How can I let them go on a festival when they have so much more important work to do for me here? If they have so much surplus time on their hands, they must not be working as hard as they can. So let us see how well they work when the straw for their bricks is not provided for them tomorrow." At this point, it was clear that Moses had not thought things through entirely. Somehow he expected Pharaoh to simply capitulate such a ridiculous command. Such primitive theology, too, don't you think? One God. There are too many areas of life for there to be only one. Were I to worship only one God, only one area of my life would be satisfactory, and the rest would suffer. No, if my life is to be full and rich and happy, I must satisfy the gods of every area of my life in a way that makes them happy. One God. I have never known a single person to truly only worship one God in their life. Moses was the first I had heard to make the claim. And in making this claim, he brought severe hardship upon his people. Because the same number of bricks was required of them as when their straw had been provided. And an Egyptian taskmaster whose quota is not met is, shall we say, prone to violence. And so soon, the Hebrews were also angry with Moses. But his campaign had only begun. He returned to Pharaoh with Aaron and made his same demand, this time beginning his string of magic tricks. The brother of Moses cast a wooden staff down upon the floor and it became a snake. Not bad. Nice party trick. Our Egyptian sorcerers did the same with their staffs, so my brother was not impressed and certainly did not relent. Although Moses' snake did eat the Egyptian snakes, I have always wondered whether they tasted like snake or like wood. The next morning, Moses met Amenhotep as he went down to the Nile for his dawn row and said that if Pharaoh did not release the Hebrews, Moses would strike the Nile with his staff and it would turn into undrinkable, stinking blood and kill all the fish. No, Pharaoh reacts well to a threat, but particularly my brother. So Moses did as he promised, and it all happened as he promised as well. But then our magicians were able to produce the same effect with their magic arts, so we reached yet another stalemate. My brother did not relent, and the Hebrews were not released. I will say it was a grave disappointment that the gods of the Nile, Isis and Osiris, did not hear our cries despite our sacrifices and did not come and cleanse the water as we asked. And thus began the plagues. Each one set squarely in the sphere of influence of one or more of Egypt's gods, who all remained silent and sterile. After the bloody Nile came the plague of frogs to rival the image of the wife of the Creator, the goddess Hecht. Next, the dust of the earth became gnats to torment human and animal alike, to mock Geb, god of earth. These first three plagues fell upon all peoples, Hebrews and Egyptians and alike, but those that followed fell only upon the Egyptians. Flies swarmed upon us and in our homes to mock the image of Kepher, the god of creation with the face of a fly. Next, Apis, the sacred bull, and Hathor, the goddess of protection with the head of a cow, were attacked as every piece of livestock in Egypt died. Every horse, every donkey, every camel, cow, and sheep was dead. But the Hebrews' animals lived on. Next, painful boils erupted on all of us to mock Imhotep, our physician god, and Thoth, our god of healing. Then hail and fire fell from the sky, taunting the gods of the sky, Nut and Horus. And then came the locusts. Egypt was black with them. You could not see the land beneath. There were so many. Impotent, the gods of harvest sat idly by, Ermutet and Neper, and watched as the locusts consumed every grain, every fruit, every seed, every leaf, plant, and tree. They came into our homes, into every crack and crevice, and devoured every source of food for the coming months, for the coming years. And then an immutable darkness fell upon Egypt, so thick one could not see the next person, and we had to stand where we were for 3 days until the light returned. It was as if Re had ceased to exist, but the Egyptians had light, but the Hebrews had light where they lived. Throughout these several plagues, there were times when Amenhotep said that he would release the Hebrews, but then withdrew his promise as soon as danger had passed. Or he would negotiate conditions, seeking to ensure the return of the slaves after their festival, but Moses would not compromise, and neither would my brother. The Hebrews found favor in the Egyptian people who had suffered at the hands of this Hebrew God. And so when the Hebrews asked the people for silver and gold and clothing, they gave them all to the Hebrews. And still Pharaoh would not yield. And so the final plague fell upon Egypt, striking at its greatest power, Pharaoh himself, divine God. And every firstborn of Egypt, male or female, human or animal, died in the middle of the night, including the son of Amenhotep II, including the son of Menkheperre. My son. And a great cry rose up from across the nation as every household in Egypt experienced death. And the proud and arrogant heart of Pharaoh was finally broken, shattered by his loss. And he summoned Moses and Aaron in the middle of the night and commanded them, ordered them to leave, to take all of the Hebrews, all of their flocks, all of their herds with them. And the people of Egypt urged the Hebrews to leave quickly because it felt that if they were there for another moment, not a single life in Egypt would remain. And so the Hebrews fled, wave after wave, endless streams of slaves pouring out of Egypt. They had come in as a single Hebrew family, and they left as a Hebrew nation. And when their exit was finally complete, an unnerving silence fell across the land. Gone were the sounds of hammer and chisel, the cries of the overseers and the slaves, the cracks of the whips. All building had ceased. All life had ceased. And Pharaoh and his advisors awoke as if from a dream and said, "What have we done to release Israel from our service? With no slaves, the stones shall be silent." And so Pharaoh and his armies of chariots pursued the Hebrews who had seemingly trapped themselves against the sea foolishly. And so Pharaoh and his chariots approached, but then the staff of Moses, which seemed a mere party trick in the beginning, was extended over the waters, and they parted. And the Hebrews walked through the sea on dry land, while a great pillar of fire stood in the way, preventing my brother and his forces from following. When the pillar was finally removed, they pursued the Hebrews into the sea. But then Moses called the waters down upon Egypt, and all her forces drowned, including my brother. I have ruled in his place and in his name now for nearly 20 years. I have brought us back from the brink of utter destruction, slowly but surely. Fortunately, our surrounding adversaries have been concerned with their other borders for some time, giving me room to recover. I have enslaved tens of thousands from our outlying territories in order to replace the Hebrews. And building has begun again. My brother was wrong about many things. He was wrong about how hard the Hebrews worked, because none of these new slaves, no matter their race, works nearly as hard or as well as the Hebrews did. Not a day passes that I do not go back to those chilling days, for their effects will be felt for years to come. Had I not witnessed it with my own eyes, I never would have believed that our own slaves could bring Egypt to its knees to beg for mercy. But that is precisely what happened. The gods in whom we trust and to whom we sacrifice were nowhere to be found when we were in need, a trait entirely too human for a god. Many keep to the old ways as a matter of habit. They continue to sacrifice to these gods who never answered us. They continue to make sacrifice to Ra, to Horus, to all of them. But there are some who suggest a radical new theology, particularly the next generation. They look at our gods, at Pharaoh's, at all of Egypt's inability to stand against this I am of the Hebrews. And they say, perhaps there is only one God. My son, Thutmose IV, and his friends talk of worshiping this one God, and I forbid them to call this God the I Am. They say that we have parceled out and chopped up this one God into different identities, and they seek to bring them all back together into one. And since I will not allow this God to be named I Am, they assemble some of our God names into one, Re Horus Aten, I think. We will see how long their monotheism lasts. No record of Moses, or of the plagues, or of the Hebrews themselves will be placed in the stones, nor even of my efforts in our recovery. Should our enemies ever learn how we were defeated by slaves without a chariot, without a weapon, without an army, the nations would unite against us and make us all wish we had drowned in the sea behind the Hebrews. Our crime was not enslaving the Hebrews. Conscripting a labor force from a lesser peoples that one has power over is expected, necessary. Everyone uses other people to get what they want to achieve their goals. Neither was great-grandfather's thinning process our offense. One's assets must always be kept in a controllable state. No, the pharaohs failed in two places. The first pharaoh who failed was my great-grandfather Thutmose I. He should have been more vigorous and destroyed and exterminated more slaves in his generation. Perhaps this would not have happened. But the Hebrews grew in unnatural ways, in numbers that seemed to indicate that this God of theirs was using Egypt as an incubator. In which case, as we have learned, there was nothing we could do to stop him. But my brother could have released the slaves earlier if he had recognized when the phenomena of the plague surpassed the abilities of our magicians. We should have realized that was the time. Our sorcerers made snakes out of sticks. They changed water into blood. They even called forth their own plague of frogs from the water. But when the I Am turned dust into living creatures, no matter how small, we should have known that we were trusting in things that could never save us in the face of such power. Had we acted then, we would still have our crops, our livestock, our children. What price have we paid for our proud arrogance, for our conviction that our way is the only way to look at the universe, for the thought that simply by believing something, we make it so? Perhaps the Hebrews are right. Perhaps there is only one God. That would be far more convenient than having to satisfy the menu of gods I must in Egypt. But it is also a frightening prospect, is it not? Because if I fall out of favor with the one God, there are no other gods to turn to ask for help. Although our cries to all our gods for help went unanswered. As I said, I have never known a single person to only have one God on the throne of their hearts. Let's be honest. So choose well your gods. Because I assure you, if they ever have to stand against the God of the Hebrews, this I Am, they will not stand. I say, choose your gods and choose them well.